Okay, dear students, we are in the home stretch. Okay, you got a couple more presentations. I know, this is a lot of material, but it's important because stocks are sexy, stocks are exciting, stocks are risky. Yeah. So, in this presentation, we will look at the different types of common stocks. And finally, try to get our arms around the idea of growth versus value. Growth versus value. And then we'll finish with a discussion of what is called market capitalization. Okay? So let's get started on slide 75. These types of common stocks are very general, and I basically took most of this, folks, from a book called One Up on Wall Street by Peter Lynch. There's a little bibliography on the website and in Canvas that says, you know what, these are really good books for you to read. And they are. Specifically, the One Up on Wall Street is a great book to start with. Another good book to start with is A Random Walk Down Wall Street. And eventually you're going to want to read The Intelligent Investor. So check out the commentary, check out the bibliography. Don't read that one first, okay? But we'll refer to that one often. In fact, in this presentation. So let's get started on slide 75. Blue chip stocks. These are the financially strong, high quality stocks with long and stable records of earnings and dividends. Peter Lynch calls them the stalwarts. You know who these are. The brand names that everybody can rattle off. They are often referred to as value stocks. Stick with us here. They attract conservative investors. And we're not talking about politics, folks. We're talking about people who want to invest in stocks, yes, and know that it's risky, but they want stocks that exhibit far less risk than more speculative, smaller, or just more speculative, which we'll get to in a few slides here, stocks. Examples, General Electric, General Motors. Oh, no, what's going on? Oh, yeah, these two companies for decades were the bluest of the blue. Are they still? Well, yes, but General Motors is not the same company it was several years ago, and GE certainly is not the same company it was several years ago, but not like what happened to General Motors, as we'll see. But yes, they're still big companies, and this is the reality these days. It used to be that there were companies that just you never worried about their future, but not anymore. The world is changing so fast that that even stalwarts, even the blue chips. And where does the name blue chip? Even the blue chips can fall. You ever hear of Kodak? Some of you have heard of Kodak. It used to be ubiquitous. You like that word, ubiquitous? Everywhere. Those little yellow boxes of film that nobody uses anymore. Where did the term blue chip come from? Well, it actually comes from gambling, believe it or not, because over 100 years ago, 150 or more years ago, only gentlemen owned stock. Women weren't even allowed to own stock. Gentlemen owned stock, and gentlemen gambled. It's what a gentleman did. And the blue chips were the most expensive stocks. We don't like gambling in stock investing, but some do. And then the second group are income stocks. These are stocks with long and sustained records of paying higher than average dividend. They could be blue chips. They don't have to be. And they also often are referred to as value stocks. What are income stocks? Well, they are normally slow growth companies in mature industries. And the two tremendous examples are utilities and banks. Well, utilities never lost their income stock status, but banks started to get real scary after 1999, when they lifted all the constraints that were on our banks. And then we saw what happened in the 2000s. Yeah, right. They crashed and we had to bail them out. And on my homepage is a link to a gentleman who's very, very sharp. You got to check it out. The banksters and how and what happens when the banks hold the economy hostage. Check that out. Banks are becoming boring again. It's taking a while, but they're becoming boring income stocks again. We can rely on these for regular and steady dividends. They don't grow that fast. Yeah, these income stocks. Now the next category, slide 76, are growth stocks. These are stocks that experience high rates of growth in operations and earnings. The growth rate, typically 15 to 20%. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it is. 20% growth, you're twice as big in 3 years. Often no dividends at all. Why? Because they're reinvesting that money back in the company. Maybe they pay a small dividend, maybe not. The stock should go up, but folks, it's going to be very volatile, which is a fancy word for, it fell. Now, what are the examples here? Intel, Microsoft, Hewlett-Packard. Wait a minute! Are Intel, Microsoft, and Hewlett-Packard still growth stocks? Well, you know, my understanding is Intel and Microsoft are still growing, but HP is split into two, and who knows what's going on with them, but it turns out that the original core business of printing is actually doing pretty well. Yes, but not like they used to be, folks. 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when everybody was buying their first PC and learning about this new technology called the Infernal Net, yeah, they were tremendous growth stocks. That's not to say that they're not going to continue to grow in the future. Intel is still holding its own, and Microsoft is supposedly doing very well with its cloud-based services. I wouldn't touch them with a 39.5-foot pole, but I'm showing my bias against Microsoft now. I just wonder why people still use their software after being kicked so many times and spit on, and they still use their software. It always amazes me. So, who are the growth stocks now? Right, the internet-based companies like Netflix and Amazon and Facebook and Twitter. Right, Tesla. Who else? They call them the FANGs. Google, right? Apple, of course. And so these are the sexy growth stocks. Now, slide 77, folks. Here's where we finally try to get our arms around this idea of growth versus value. As we said way back in chapter 4, you have to be careful when you use that term value. Because the investment world loves to throw around the terms growth and value. But the meanings of the terms are not exact. It depends on who you're talking to, because people will use the terms differently. Typically, investors often use the term growth to designate a high PE stock, while they use the term value to designate a low PE stock. Now, you remember price to earnings ratio? The higher the price-to-earnings ratio, the more the investment world believes the future for that company is bright and exciting, and they're looking for it to grow their earnings and become worth more. A company with a low PE, well, the investment world isn't really that excited about that company. Now, it doesn't mean they're right. You know, come back in 3 to 5 years, and we'll see what's the case. But that's not what the word value means. The word value to me doesn't mean it's got a low PE. No, to me it means there's something worthwhile there. There's something attractive. Even if it has a high PE or has a low PE, there's something that I, as an investor, am interested in. And a high PE stock might be a great value, whereas a low PE stock might not be a great value. So be careful. And here's an unbelievably phenomenal example. In January of 2005, Google was selling for around $200 with a sky-high PE. I think it was 70 or 80 or something up there. And you have to go back to 2004. Google went public in August of 2004 at around $85 and went up to $200 quickly. and the PE just was, woo, that's a high PE. The old GM, and remember, GM went through bankruptcy and disappeared in 2008-09 as a stock, was selling for $34 with a very low PE. I think it was 5 or 6. And a huge dividend. It was paying very good. Even though they weren't making that much money, they were still paying a huge dividend. And so you'd think, you know, Google's the growth stock, GM's the value stock. Well, what happened, right? Now Google sells for about $2,100. Now that's a split-adjusted an amount. If you go look it up, it actually is half that. You'll say, oh, okay, because that's because it's split, right? With a much lower PE. The PE is not in the 70 or 80 nosebleed section. It's still pretty high. And the old GM stock, the old company, is gone. They renamed the shares Motors Liquidation. First they called it Liquidation Motors, and I guess people got upset with that because instead of General Motors, it was Liquidation Motors. So they changed the name to Motors Liquidation. And that stock still sold even after GM fell into bankruptcy. Even though the company was gone, the stock was worthless, it still traded until March of 2011 when it last traded for 4 cents. And now if you own that stock, it's worthless. You can't even sell it. Nobody wants it from you. So which one was the better value? So be careful when you hear people throw around those terms, growth and value. You need to pin them down about whether they are talking about just a low PE stock or they're talking about something that has worth to it, that it's exciting and it's something that is attractive to you. Even if it has a high PE, it still might be a good value. Okay? So now, let's take a look at slide 78 and look at speculative stocks. Now, these are typically growth stocks, but not necessarily. These are companies with a very high degree of risk. They are losing money or have very low earnings relative to their valuation. They will offer the possibility of substantial capital gains. But, dear students, they also offer the possibility, often more likely, of substantial capital losses. And who are these stocks? Alternative fuels, marijuana, biotechnology, internet, the new technology! You see, in the late 1990s, some of these internet-based companies were not going to make any money for years. They were losing money, and the more money they lost, the more their stock went up. Figure that one out. And people thought, well, it's the future. Well, guess what? The future couldn't come fast enough for some of these companies, and they're all gone. So anybody out there want to buy Tesla stock? Folks, Tesla is an amazing company. What they've done, it's just insane what they've done in just the last 10, 12 years. But they ain't making any money. They're losing money. They're losing money faster than they can imagine. And even though there are 400,000 people who have signed up for their Model 3, they've only delivered about 3,000 or 4,000 of them or so. So before you go out and buy Tesla, and I'm not dissing Tesla, folks. I am rooting for them. I'm not going to buy their stock, but I'm excited about what they've done. Before you go out there, go take a look at the history of GoPro. GoPro. Here was another speculative stock that people bid the price up dramatically. They had one product. No, they have a few more, but they basically they had cameras, right? They had cameras that you put on your helmet or you take diving with you. And I had a student who kept telling me how wonderful they were, and I kept saying, well wait a minute, you know, cameras, digital cameras. Lots of people have them. Where's Nike? You know, Nikon. Where's Canon? Where's Apple and Samsung? And it turns out that the market for those things just wasn't that big, and the stock plummeted. So be careful. And this gives us yet another opportunity to go back and quote from Mr. Benjamin Graham, who wrote The Intelligent Investor. An investment operation is one which, upon thorough analysis, promises safety of principle and a satisfactory return. Operations not meeting these requirements are speculative. And again, I'm going to say I'm rooting for Tesla. They, in fact, Mr. Musk, who is an amazing individual, what he's done with SpaceX alone, I mean, nobody believed 10, 12 years ago that they'd be able to ever land a rocket and then reuse it, and he's done it several times. He said several years ago that he doesn't care if Tesla succeeds or not. He is more interested in seeing the world change to electric cars. And so far, that part of his mission, he's succeeded. Now all the major car companies are scrambling over themselves to make exciting, fun-to-drive electric cars. And folks, before you diss electric cars, there's no oil, there's no radiator, there's no power. The fluids are gone. You know, there's fewer moving parts. The engines will last. The motors will last for years, providing you don't burn them out. They'll outlive you. They're basically the same technology that powers an elevator, and pretty amazing, pretty amazing. So check Tesla out. But that's if you're a speculative kind of person, then go buy it. If not, stay away from it, because the parachutes had better be very large if they don't deliver all those Model 3s that are on order. Slide 79, cyclical stocks. Cyclical stocks, you mean they're round? No. Cyclical stocks are companies whose earnings and overall market performance are closely linked to the general state of the economy. They follow the business cycle of advances and declines. And the poster child for cyclical stocks are automobiles. Yes, the poster children. But also timber, steel, and any company that makes stuff. Because as the economy ramps up and people are getting better jobs and they're getting raises, and what do they want? They want a new car! Oh yeah! What's wrong with the old car? Oh, nothing, but I want a new car. I like that new car smell. It's good for your lungs. Yeah, and then what happens if there's a recession and people are losing their jobs, or at least they're not getting raises? Do they go out and buy a new car? No. So you look at the car companies, and it's like a roller coaster. It's a cycle. They make tons of money when the economy improves and grows, and they lose tons of money when the economy falters. And that's why back in 2006 and 5 and 6, I kept looking at GM saying, it's going down. They're going down. The next recession, they're not going to be able to survive. Now, I wasn't wishing that on them, but I was really scared. And I kept telling myself, go ahead, short them, short them. I said, no, you don't want anybody to be, you want everyone to be successful. I mean, everybody can't, but you want to root for everyone. And I just remember Peter Lynch saying, don't short. And I'm apologize if I'm getting in, remember we talked about shorting very briefly. In other words, you want the company to fail. That's what shorting is. So think about companies that make stuff that is used in the building of new products. And those are the cyclical companies. And now, technology companies, right? Everything you buy has got a chip in it. So Intel and AMD and the other chip makers have become cyclical companies. They've gotten to the point where the new stuff is coming out and the economy expands, more stuff is bought, and so we have more chips. Now, the other side of the coin here are defensive stocks. These are companies that tend to hold their own or even do well when the economy starts to falter. They remain stable during declines in the market. Now, they don't necessarily do well when the market's zooming ahead and the economy is zooming ahead. They're often associated, but not always, with income stocks. And what are examples of this? Food companies. Consumer products, Kellogg's. Do you eat more Cheerios or Corn Flakes because the economy's doing better? Do you eat fewer Cheerios or Corn Flakes because the economy's doing worse? No, you eat your food because you got to have food. And you use diapers, and you use soap and toothpaste and shaving cream. Because you need it, right? Also, drug companies tend to be defensive stocks, but they have their own cycles with regard to new drugs and the like. But do you take more insulin because the economy's doing better? No, you take your insulin because your doctor told you to take your insulin. And if the economy does badly, you still take your insulin. And it's a bit of a truism. It doesn't always happen. But when the stocks fall, when the economy falters and stocks fall, defensive stocks sometimes actually do better. Why? Because traders, speculators, will rotate into the defensive sector. They still want to be in stocks, but they believe that the defensive stocks are going to actually do better than the other companies because the economy's faltering. Okay, now, the next three are sort of on the edges that we should be able to identify them, but they're not the typical stock that we will deal with. And we're talking about turnaround stocks here. Turnarounds. I don't like the word turnaround because most turnarounds don't do it. I call them goners. But no, some of them do turn around. These are companies that have fallen on hard times. And what you have to ask yourself as a potential investor is, can this company rebound? Can it come back? You'll hear people say, it has to come back. It has to. Oh, yeah, no, it doesn't. Their history is filled with companies that were once at the top of their game and are now gone. But most people, most certainly younger people, don't remember a time in the early 1980s when Chrysler almost disappeared. I mean, their cars were really bad in the 1970s. They weren't the only ones, but they were pretty darn bad. And Chrysler almost disappeared. And this is a great opportunity for you business-related folks, you folks who are interested in getting a career in business. Check out Lee Iacocca. Lee Iacocca, he's the gentleman who was responsible for the Ford Mustang back in the 1960s. And he took over Chrysler. And he was the one who first did it. He worked for a dollar a year. That he actually made a whole lot of money, more money through stock options. But he worked for a dollar. And in other words, if the company doesn't come back, his stock options, his stocks are going to be worthless. And he did. They did. He wasn't the only one, but they brought the company back from extinction. And that's the same thing that's happened now with Ford, GM, and Chrysler. They are turnarounds, and they seem to have survived the storm. You look at Ford and GM, and they're doing okay, you know, not nothing. They're not perfect, but very few companies are. But they seem to have survived that storm of the Great Recession. I'm actually pretty. They're both doing fairly well. I'm actually pretty impressed with Ford. They are trying to get into Asia, and I think they're going to be really popular. That Ford F-150, folks, is the biggest selling vehicle in the United States, and I think eventually it's going to sell crazily well in Asia. So we'll see. You'll see. Not to be construed as a recommendation for your portfolio, folks. But I'm rooting for them. What can I say? Now, the next category are asset plays. Huh? What are these? These are companies that are sitting on an asset that could be sold or spun off. Yeah, you see the company and you think, oh, you know, it's JCPenney's. Well, they're a retail business. Well, you know, there's something behind that retail business. They also have an insurance division that they could easily sell if they needed money to stay afloat. Now, the whole department store space, as they call it, the space, is under siege. Macy's and JCPenney's. Who else? They're having a hard go of it, folks, because they're getting hit from the bottom by the Amazons and the Walmarts, and they're getting hit from the top by the specialty boutique retailers. And many of them are gone. And many of you might remember the May Company, Robinson's, Montgomery Ward's, Mervon, the Broadway. They're all gone. And a lot of people are not too happy, not too excited about the prospects for Penny's, Macy's, Sears, yeah. But JCPenney's has that insurance division that they could sell, and I think they did sell the drugstore a long time ago. Who else? You see Pepsi, right? You think, oh, Pepsi, you know, they sell Coca, they sell metal, they sell cola, they sell drinks, soft drinks. Pepsi owns Frito-Lay. Yeah, amazing. And I think they still own a big chunk of what's called Yum Brands. Who are they? That's the company that makes Pizza Crap, Kentucky Fried Rat, and Taco Smell. I'm sorry, what is it? Yeah, right. Pizza Hut, Kentucky Fried Chicken and Taco Bell. And so you see Pepsi, but you have to dig deeper and realize that, oh, there's an asset hiding under there that we didn't see. Now, these last ones, oh boy, folks, penny stocks, we really shouldn't even discuss these in polite company, folks. You ladies out there, hold your ears, because this is strong language. I'm joking. Penny stocks, what are these? Any one of thousands of sham companies out there, folks. They're not real corporations. I mean, they are. Technically, they're a corporation. They've been incorporated. All the paperwork's done at the Secretary of State's office. But it's somebody's garage somewhere in Idaho or Iowa or one of those places that starts with a letter I. I mean, they're nothing. And they have bizarre names that don't mean anything or do mean something, but it really isn't a company. And we have plenty of examples on the website and in Canvas of these things. Folks, don't get rooked in. Please don't believe any of the people say, oh, you can make a ton of money with penny stocks. No, you aren't going to make the money. And please do listen to the presentations, look at the examples. They're scams, so stay away from them. Okay? Enough said. All right. Slide number 81, foreign stocks, international stocks. Well, typically, these were companies that were difficult for us as investors in the United States to buy. Why? Because they were based in other countries. So if you wanted to buy them, you had to change your dollars into yen or change your dollars into pounds or pesos and get a brokerage account there in that company, in that country, I'm sorry. And it was just not easy. So what did big banks and trust companies and brokerage firms do? They went to Japan and bought a ton of Toyota and Sony stock and brought it to New York, and they went to Finland and bought a ton of Nokia stock, and they went to Europe and bought a ton of Unilever and brought it to New York, and they reissued that stock as what are called American Depository Receipts, ADRs. You might see GDRs, that stands for Global Depository Receipts, or you might just see DR, which stands for Depository Receipts. So in other words, now you can buy Toyota stock, you can buy Unilever or Nokia with dollars, and you don't have to worry about international brokerage accounts or changing your dollars into yen or pesos or whatever. And typically most of us would invest through global and international mutual funds because the mutual funds have the wherewithal, they have the technology. But more and more, dear students, more brokerage firms are offering international accounts based in the United States. So they're actually very simple to use. You have your dollars, but inside the brokerage account, you can change your dollars to yen or to euros or to pesos and then place an order on their exchanges in Tokyo, in London, in Frankfurt or Mexico City and buy their shares. Cool? Now, there's a problem with this, all right? It's not a problem. I shouldn't say it's a problem, but it's something that you need to be aware of because what you have to ask yourself is what's going to happen with the currency, because there's a seesaw relationship here. If the dollar gets stronger, all the things being equal, and they never are, your investment overseas becomes worthless. It has a negative impact. The dollar goes up, your investment goes down. If the dollar goes down, all the things being equal, and they never are, your investment overseas goes up. Right. And so some people play that game. They try to anticipate what's going to happen with the currency. Over the long term, our currency has gone and been strong. It's been weak. It's been strong. It's been weak. But relatively, the dollar always is fairly strong relative to other currencies. Not always. And you have to ask yourself, will the dollar be stronger or weaker in the coming years? But that's the secondary issue. The first issue is it a good company to buy? And so you have to realize that you're setting you're going to have to deal with this issue. I apologize. I am of the opinion that the dollar is fairly strong right now, so it's a great time to buy overseas assets. Now, I don't do it in an international brokerage account, folks. I use global mutual funds. I let the mutual fund company worry about all the back room office accounting. I don't have to do the changing of currencies. But I don't know if the dollar is going to fall that much. Why? Because of oil. And why is that? Well, we pay for our oil in dollars. And up until about, 8-9 years ago, we were importing a ton of oil. We were importing 66% of our oil. And we're not doing that anymore. So those dollars are not flowing out of our country. And that's keeping the dollar strong. But will it stay this strong? I don't know. I don't think so. It doesn't mean I'm right. We'll come back in 5 years and see how the dollar fared. But that's a secondary issue. The first issue is this a good company? Is this a good global mutual fund? Because you want your, in my humble opinion, you want your mutual fund managers who are doing your investing on your behalf to go out and find the best company, no matter where it is. But that's my opinion. There are others who say, no, stay in the United States. You buy large companies in the United States, you're investing globally, because Coca-Cola makes 80% of its money outside the United States. So you're going to hear other viewpoints. I'm right, of course. teasing. Slide number 82. Let's finish with a discussion of capitalization. Now, that's a fancy word, folks, capitalization. We usually just say cap, large cap, mid cap, small cap. And what does it mean? It's the value of the company. Everybody keys on the price of the stock. But, folks, the price of the stock is meaningless until it goes down to 4 cents or 5 cents. Then it's a penny stock. Stay away from it. But it's the valuation that's important. So in other words, you don't know what the company is actually worth just by knowing the stock price. You have to know how many shares are outstanding. And you compute the capitalization by taking the price of the stock times the number of shares outstanding. Now, we're going to do a few calculations, folks, but really, you don't have to. It's online. All you do is look it up. Right? And there are three major categories. Large cap, mid cap, small cap. And these are the papa bears, the mama bears, and the baby bears. Now, these categories change over time, and I'm using the ones that were generally considered about 4 or 5 years ago, but you hear more and more people say, no, large cap isn't 10 billion, it's 15. But anything considered 10 or above, $10 billion of capitalization, we'll consider large cap in our class, even though we hear rumblings of people wanting to raise that limit to 15. And then there's a subcategory called mega cap. Those are companies that are worth hundreds of billions of dollars. We're not there yet. We haven't had the first $1 trillion company, but it's coming. It's coming, maybe. Who knows? So they're the papa bears, right? Papa bears. I don't know if that Goldilocks, papa bear, mama bear, baby bear, if that makes any sense. But the mid-cap stocks. Now, these are companies, some of which you've heard of, many of which you've never heard of. And we are going to use the category that was popular about a few years ago, and still kind of popular with some people, $2 billion to $10 billion. Right, medium-sized companies. Now, some people are saying, oh, no, $4 billion, no, $3, $4 billion, up to $15 billion. So you decide which numbers you want to use, because they're squishy. It depends on who you talk to. And then small cap stocks are anything from about $100 million to $2 billion, $3 billion, $4 billion. Some people are saying, oh no, $4 billion is still a small company. I don't buy it. But it changes over time. And then there's a subcategory in small caps. And those are called micro caps. Anything less than about $100 million, $70 million, $80 million, $50 million, down to $10 million, that's a micro cap company, folks. These are very, very risky companies. But remember, every large cap company was originally a small company someday, right? And so that's where the growth is, and that's where the danger is. And as we said back in chapter 1, those numbers that say that small cap stocks do better than large cap stocks over time are ignoring all the stocks that disappeared. Survivorship bias, right? And then we shouldn't, again, even discuss penny stocks in polite company. And it used to be if a stock price got down below $5, they called it a penny stock. Well, that's not really true anymore because of technology. As we said before, I don't know if you remember, if the stock price got down below 5, the New York Stock Exchange didn't want you anymore. They just didn't want you on their exchange. And I think it's still a dollar for the NASDAQ. But again, technology has sort of taken that boogeyman away from them. But once it gets down to pennies, just forget it. It's not a real company. Or it was a real company, and now they're a goner. Maybe they're a turnaround. So let's take a look at an example on slide 83. The price of this company is $20. The number of shares is 5 million. So we really just, the price is irrelevant unless we know what the number of shares outstanding is. So we take $20 times 5 million shares and we get a market capitalization of 100 million. This is a small cap stock, right? Remember, the stock price, everybody keys in the stock price, but for the most part, until you get the, you know, the penny stocks, 25 cents, 5 cents, the stock price is irrelevant. You must look at the market cap to see what the value of the company is. Remember Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway? They own Geico, they own Dairy Queen, and they own a bunch of companies. See's Candy, and they have a ton of Coca-Cola stock, and McDonald's, and Procter & Gamble. He never, never split the shares. So there's a lot fewer shares of Berkshire Hathaway, but they're $300,000 a share. So don't get all hung up on the share price. Look at the market capitalization. So let's take a look at a couple of examples, a couple of capitalization examples. Here are two mom and pop shops that sell assorted sundry objects, Walmart and Target, right, exactly. And if you were to just look at the price, which is what most people look at, you'll see that Walmart, as of August 31st, 2018, was selling for $95.86. And Target selling for $87.50. So you might think that, you know, they're about the same size. No. Intuitively, who is larger? Who do you think is larger? You know who's larger. Why? Because Walmart has almost 3 billion shares, while Target has a little over 500 million shares. So what's the market capitalization price times the number of shares outstanding? Walmart is about, what, 6 times, 7 times larger than Walmart. I'm sorry, yeah, than Target. Walmart is 5-6 times larger than Target. Why? Walmart is global. Target is still based mostly in the United States. Doesn't mean it's not a very profitable company. It's still a large cap company, $46 billion. But Walmart is a mega cap, over $100 billion. Make sense? So, think about it. If you wanted to buy Walmart, you would need almost $300 billion. And then you walk on down to the New York Stock Exchange where it is listed and say, I want to buy Walmart. Nobody's going to buy Walmart, folks. But there are companies that have enough cash to buy Target. Apple has this, and Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's company, they have, you know, tens of billions of dollars, $100 billion. They could buy Target. Not that they're not going to buy Target. And what would happen if they tried? What would happen? Well, as soon as somebody started buying up all the shares that were for sale, what would happen to the price? Right, it would start rising and people would go, what's going on? And so now when one company wants to take over another company or when somebody wants to take a company private, they go to the exchange and say, look, you know, we want to buy Target and we've got $55 billion because they have to pay a premium because, as you see, as soon as you started bidding up, as soon as you started buying all the shares, the price would rise dramatically anyway. So they usually have to pay about 10%, 20% more than the going price. And there's a set methodology for doing this. There's a set way to take over the one company.
And that's why, you know, there's all kinds of rules so that you know why the insider can jump ahead of everybody else and say, ah, ha, 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 ha. So they announced that we have what's called a tender offer. Yeah. Slide number 85. Let's take a look at another example. A couple of little telecommunication companies, the duopoly, AT&T versus Verizon. T-Mobile, Sprint, who knows if they ever actually get together again, but they're in third and fourth place, and they're a lot far behind the other two, AT&T and Verizon. So you're looking at the price, and you think, well, AT&T is a lot smaller than no, you have to look at the number of shares outstanding, because it turns out that AT&T has almost twice the number of shares, 7.26 billion versus 4.13 billion shares. So it turns out that these companies are about equal to one another. AT&T is a little bit larger, $232 billion, and Verizon, $224 billion, with a B, which means they are both mega cap companies. Makes sense. Okay, now, where does that leave us? Well, we're almost finished. We're almost finished our introduction to stocks. And in our final chapter, we'll take a look at some strategies, okay? Study, 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 bring honor and glory to Southwestern Community College. We are so proud of you, dear students. Don't give up, never give up, bring, I already said that. Well, amaze your friends and families, because now you are the investment guru for your friends and family and coworkers, and it's a very serious responsibility. We are proud of you.